From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, filling in today for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Maurice Sendak. The famous children's book author explored the inner terrors of childhood in his classic picture books, Where the Wild Things Are and In the Night Kitchen. Sendak has a new book, We Are All in the Dumps with Jack and Guy, a nursery rhyme about a group of homeless kids. Also, understanding Yasser Arafat, journalist Andrew Gowers has written a new biography that chronicles the PLO leader's career, from Arafat's student activist days to his current attempts to forge a relationship with Israel. And commentator Maureen Carrigan reviews The Buccaneers, the final novel by Edith Wharton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The number of people killed in an Amtrak train derailment near Mobile, Alabama, now stands at 40. 13 people are still unaccounted for. The Miami-bound train jumped a track on a bridge, plunging four of its cars into a bayou. NPR's Thuy Vu reports.
Of the four cars either partially or completely submerged, two contained passengers and one carried three crew members. The crew's lead locomotive also contains a box that records crucial information about the train at the time of the accident, such as brake pressure and speed. Rescue teams are still trying to get through to the lead unit. The accident is the most serious Amtrak has had to date. Amtrak spokesman Clifford Black says before today, 48 people had died in train crashes in all of Amtrak's history.
It is conceivable that today's catastrophic accident could equal or eclipse the entire fatality rate for our entire 23-year history.
Amtrak and federal transportation officials still don't know what caused the derailment. I'm Thuy Vu in Washington.
There were more protests today over the Israeli-Palestinian self-rule agreement. Jewish settlers on the West Bank drove a 60-car convoy through the town of Jericho, where Palestinians are scheduled to take control when the agreement goes into effect. Demonstrations also continued outside the Israeli parliament, where lawmakers are debating the agreement. About 150 protesters tried to break into the building before police turned them back. There were also reports of street fighting between rival factions of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Despite the serious risks involved, Russian President Boris Yeltsin has won backing from much of the West after dissolving the parliament and ordering new elections. NPR's Anne Garrels has this roundup.
Messages to Yeltsin have carried understanding and sympathy, if not outright support. British Prime Minister John Major accused Yeltsin's opponents of fighting a rearguard action to block the people's will and paralyze reform. German Chancellor Helmut Kohl said he's convinced a continuation of reforms is the best path for a better future for the Russian people. The European community considers Yeltsin's decision an inevitable consequence of the impasse created by conservatives who have sabotaged the process of democratization. But with words of support came warnings. For a top Swedish official, all this indicates just how unstable Russia remains. And while the hope is new elections will reinvigorate reforms, French Foreign Minister Juppé said, I hope reformers who are ready to stand up and face a ballot will come out on top. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials gained 10 points to close at 3,547. The NASDAQ Composite Index, which is dominated by technology stocks, gained 12 points to close at 745.5. This is NPR News. John Demjanjuk returned to the United States today, avoiding protesters who say he should be punished for Nazi war crimes. The Israeli Supreme Court ordered Demjanjuk released from prison after clearing him of charges that he was a Nazi death camp guard known as Ivan the Terrible. Demjanjuk reportedly arrived in Ohio today, but didn't return to his former home, where demonstrators from several Jewish groups were waiting for him. Senate Armed Services Chairman Sam Nunn predicts clear sailing for General John Shalikashvili to be head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but Nunn says it may be wise to delay the nomination because of events in Russia. NPR's Martha Raddatz explains.
Nunn says he would like to consult with the administration about delaying confirmation until a new NATO commander in Europe is nominated to replace Shalikashvili. The senator suggested the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs assume the role of chairman when Colin Powell departs at the end of the month. Shalikashvili did say at his confirmation hearing today that there is no indication the Russian military is getting involved in events in Moscow, but it could happen, he said.
The danger really is if lower-level commanders were to begin to choose sides. That probably would be the sort of unraveling effect that ought to give us all great concern.
The general also told the committee he was deeply disturbed at the recent revelations that his father had been associated with Hitler's Waffen-SS. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
Preliminary election results from Poland show that former communists gained 35% in last Sunday's elections. The biggest winner was a group of former communists that's now known as the Democratic Left Alliance, which won 20% of the vote for the lower house of parliament. Analysts said there was a strong protest vote from people who are angry with the Polish government's attempts at economic reform. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moskowain, filling in for Terry Gross, who's out today with a cold. Coming up, an interview Terry recently recorded with one of the favorite writers of bedtime stories. If you remember childhood as a place that included complicated emotions, where sibling rivalry flourished, where monsters lurked, and where sadness and fear sometimes kept you awake at night, then you have a friend in children's book author and illustrator Maurice Sendak. His books, which include Where the Wild Things Are, Outside Over There, and In the Night Kitchen, bring to life a distinctly unsentimental view of what we make of our early years. His new book, We Are All in the Dumps with Jack and Guy, is his first in 12 years, and it's Sendak's first book that is not about middle-class kids. We Are All in the Dumps is set in an urban landscape and deals with homelessness, sickness, and hunger. It's based on two English nursery rhymes. Terry asked him to recite them.
We are all in the dumps, for diamonds or trumps. The kittens are gone to St. Paul's. The babies are bit, the moon's in a fit, and the houses are built without walls. That's the first one. Second one. Jack and Guy went out in the rye, and they found a little boy with one black eye. Come, says Jack, let's knock him on the head. No, says Guy, let's buy him some bread. You buy one loaf and I'll buy two, and we'll bring him up as other folk do.
The first rhyme that you recited,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have known what to make of it. I'd have to say it wouldn't have made any sense to me. Well, you want to recite it one more
sure.
time?
Well, see, there are clues in it for an illustrator. We are all in the dumps
mm-hmm.
for diamonds or trumps. The kittens are gone to St. Paul's. The babies are bit. The moon's in a fit. And the houses are built without walls. Now, I think it's extraordinarily beautiful poetry, but it's like haiku. What does it mean? Well, I'm faced with a bridge game, diamonds or trumps. That means somewhere in this book, somebody's playing bridge. Not being a card player, that doesn't turn me on. So I had to learn how to play bridge. The moon's in a fit. You have to figure out why the moon is in a fit. What does it mean? The kittens are gone to St. Paul's. I mean, what does St. Paul's mean to American children primarily? And then the astonishing, extraordinary line, the houses are built without walls. I mean, that's what moved me all these years to make this work for me.
So what did that come to mean to you, the houses are built without walls?
It meant, finally, kids who have no place to live. This really started back in Los Angeles, or at least one detail, and a significant one, began in Los Angeles years ago. I was working on an opera, the LA Opera, and we came home late from a rehearsal, and I was driven back to my hotel, and we passed down some very, very posh streets in Beverly Hills. Maybe it was Rodeo Drive, but I couldn't swear to it. And there, past midnight, on the street, in this posh section of town, was just a dilapidated, ruined cardboard box with two dirty, naked kids' feet sticking out. The juxtaposition was astonishing. It's as though when everybody stopped shopping and gone home, then these kids came out, or people came out, And every city is ringed round with shantytowns, homeless. We all know that. We have it in New York. We have it in every major metropolis in this country. But it astonished me to see that juxtaposition. I got interested, and I got a book on Rio de Janeiro, and discovered that there is a ringed round, well-known shantytown, kids town around the city. And kids are abandoned. There. Little girls sold into prostitution. Little boys run away from abuse, from being abused at home. And they make their own cities. And they're as cruel to each other as any adults can be. And their lives are very, very brief. And they live in tin cans and cardboard houses and rag huts. And I suddenly began to see what dumps is. We are all in the dumps. Back in the 60s, that, of course, meant, you know, if you're in therapy, dumps means you're in a depression. Which is probably why I couldn't make anything sound out of it back then. Now dumps literally means the world. We are all in the dumps is really well describes events around the world at this point.
Your new book deals with some real world fears like homelessness and being scared by what could happen to you as a kid now. What were the real big events in your life that you found really frightening when you were young?
When I was young, the big events were being sick and being expected to die and knowing that at a very early age, I might. This was spoken. My parents were very indiscreet. My parents came from a foreign country. They were immigrants. They didn't know about Freud. They didn't know about what to say or not to say in front of children. So, and they loved us, me, my brother, and my sister, but that I suffered a good deal from very severe illnesses, not untypical of 30s children when there were no sulfa drugs and there wasn't penicillin. And you went through all the dire illnesses, and sometimes you just croaked. So it was the awareness at a very early age of mortality which pervaded my soul, apparently, and I think provided me with the basic ingredients of being an artist. That was critical. And knowing that I was vulnerable and that other children were vulnerable.
What did you have? What diseases?
Oh, you know, scarlet fever and pneumonia twice and whooping cough and chicken pox. It was the pneumonia and the scarlet fever that really nearly did me in.
Were you carefully watched over by your parents
when
you were sick?
I was so carefully watched over. They practically killed me with watching over me. So I was delicate. I was very delicate. And I was not allowed to participate in street games. And so that a lot of my early childhood was immediately spent in inventing and imagining. And happily I had superb, and still have, thank God, siblings. My brother, who is 5 years old, has spent a lot of time with me that he might have spent having fun outside in the street, drawing pictures for me and telling me stories, as did my sister, as did my parents. And so I was well provided for in terms of human companionship. But it left a very severe mark.
In those days when you were sick and everybody was worried about you dying, did you have any sense of what death was?
I don't remember that. But I do remember I was a very close companion to death. And I remember a game my father played with me, which he would not exactly call a death game, but did move in that direction, which was that if I lay in bed, which I spent a lot of time doing, and I remember in one particular place we lived in Brooklyn, we moved quite frequently because of financial problems, and just opposite the foot of my bed was a window looking out in the backyard facing a just very boring brick wall. And he said, if you looked and didn't blink, if you saw an angel, you'd be a very, very lucky child. And so I did that frequently. And, of course, I would always blink because it hurt not to blink. And then you didn't see it, and he'd say, well, you blinked, didn't you? And I say, yes. And I remember once I didn't blink, and I saw it. Or I imagined I saw it, but the memory of it is so vivid I could even describe it to you.
Would you?
Well, I was lying in the bed, obviously, staring out the window, my eyelids aching, my eyes aching, staring, and something very large, like almost like a dirigible. But it wasn't a dirigible because it was right past my window. It was a slow-moving angel. She, he, whatever, moved very gracefully and slowly, coming from left, going across to right, not turning to observe me at all. I don't have a memory of the face, but I remember a memory of the hair, the body, and the wings. It took my breath away. It just moved so slowly that I could examine it quite minutely. And then I shrieked and hollered, and my father came in. I said, I saw it. And he said, I was a very lucky kid. You will have noticed angels, and we are all in the dumps. I love angels. I'm about to say obsessed. That's hyperbole. I'm not obsessed with angels, but I do adore angels. I've never drawn them in a book, and they do appear in the new book, primarily because so many people have died recently that I have populated my book with their spirits floating around. And they're all reading the New York Times because I can't imagine. Even up there, you got to figure out what's going on every day.
So when you saw the angel, did you think that that was a sign that you were going to live or that something wonderful was going to happen?
I think it put me in alliance with death things, with important things. I can't really describe it. I really can't tell you what it meant. It's a very internal feeling, but it came out of such a complex awareness as a child of the fragility of life. There is a story which I can't prove, but I was told that at a very early age, my parents dressed me. It's a religious custom or superstition from the old country. They dressed me all in white from top to toe, so that if God is watching, he would have thought me already an angel and he would not pluck me. And I wouldn't die, in other words. I would be a fraudulent angel. This is a superstition, and it does occur in old villages in the old country. I don't know that it happened to me. But it's significant that it was a family story, so that it told me how forcefully they were concerned about me.
Did you see your parents as being really capable parents who could help fend off death or fend off whatever other problems that you had?
No, because they were so vulnerable to problems. They caved in on problems all the time. So I did not see them. And this is not a criticism of them. Their lives were extremely hard. But no, I did not see them that way.
Now, they were from Poland?
They were from Poland, yeah.
And they fled before World War I?
Yes, they did. Just before World War I. They didn't flee. My father left on a lark.
Oh, well, what was that?
He had no cause to come here. My grandfather was a rabbi. He was the youngest son, and he was obviously the spoiled younger son of my grandmother. And he actually fell in love with a young woman. And it became a little bit scandalous, and she was put on a boat and shipped off to America. And he sulked and pouted and got money out of his siblings and got on another boat to follow her here. And his family was appalled at his behavior. Because of that trivial behavior, he was the only survivor of his entire family. I mean, all of my uncles and aunts and all of the children were destroyed in concentration camps. My father's grief for his entire life was that his survival was based on such a trivial impulse. It really did cause him a lot of grief, especially when he became older.
You grew up before the Holocaust. Was he still really regretful about it?
Oh, he was terribly regretful and guilty. I mean, he had survivor guilt, as did my mother, who had much less cause, because she was shipped off when she was about 17 to come to America. She was uneducated, untrained in anything. She was a girl. My grandfather, on her side, also a rabbi, had died at a very early age of a coronary, and there was no money to take care of everybody. So she was sent here to do it, to work hard, earn money, and then bring them over, which is typical. She met my father, they married, and all the first income was spent on bringing one aunt, then an uncle, then another aunt, then my grandmother, till finally all but one brother on her side were all here. And then they were going to turn to my father's side, and then it was too late. That was in the 30s. There was no getting Jews out of Europe at that point. And so growing up during the war, that was tough, having to live through that in all its complexity. Colors your life forever.
Did your parents talk to you much about the old country?
Oh, yeah. Thank goodness. And when my father was last year of his life, paradoxically, we had a wonderful time. I took his biography down, which was wonderful. A lot of it was fantasy, and a lot of it was reality, but I was...
His biography?
Yeah.
His he wrote life. A biography?
He wrote a biography, which is not published. He did write a fairy tale, which I translated with the help of somebody else and illustrated, and that was published just before his death.
Right, right.
It's called In Grandpa's House. But his biography is not published, and I don't intend to have it published. It's a private family chronicle. We didn't get much of my mother's life. My mother was silent about that period of her life.
I think as a lot of people from Eastern Europe who came to America were. Did they seem like aliens to you because, I don't know, they're probably, did they speak more Yiddish than English?
Yes, they spoke more Yiddish. I spoke Yiddish as a child. My parents spoke English very, very late and very poorly. And we lived in a part of Brooklyn which was teeming with immigrants, either other people from Eastern Europe, Jews, or Sicilians. And I couldn't tell the difference. I mean, we lived next to the Sicilians, and I had a real, it sounds like coy conceit, but it's a fact. I had a real confusion because right across the hall from us was my best friend at one place we lived, Carmine, and his sisters and brothers and his huge mother and huge father, just across the hall. And I used to run across the hall because they had unkosher food, which is much better, much better than kosher food because it was pasta. It was great Italian cooking. And they laughed and they drank wine and they grabbed me and I sat on their laps and they had a hell of a good time. Then you come back to my house and you have these sober cuisine and not so rambunctious family life. And I really did have a confusion that Italians were happy Jews, that they were a sect.
Oh, that's really interesting.
And that I would have a choice. That I would have a choice after my bar mitzvah to belong to either the sober sect or the happy sect.
And they went to a different synagogue where they had pasta.
Yeah, I was a dumb kid. Let me tell you. I mean, all the parents looked alike. They all wore the same dull black dresses, and you couldn't tell the difference. Not to me.
My guest is the artist and writer Maurice Sendak, and his books include Where the Wild Things Are, In the Night Kitchen, Outside Over There, and a new book called We're All in the Dumps with Jack and Guy. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Artist Maurice Sendak is with us. One of the great controversies about your book, is, you know, in the night kitchen, when the character Mickey lands in the batter, he's naked, and there's this, like, little boy penis that he has, right? Yeah. And there were libraries that wouldn't carry the book or would draw little diapers over him, all kinds of silly things like that. I mean, this was not a sexual image. It was just a naked boy image,
correct.
Right?
I mean, it would have been strange had he not had a penis.
Right.
But no one has ever discussed that problem.
Right.
The astonishing and infuriating business on that book was it's one of my favorite works, and it's a rather complex work. And to have it all reduced, so to speak, to a child's penis is embarrassing and silly. And the fact that anyone could carry on about such an issue does not speak well for our culture.
Well, here's what I'm wondering. Now, that book was not about Mickey as a sexual boy or anything. But I think a lot of kids do have sexual feelings, just a little bit older than Mickey. And I was wondering if you ever thought about putting sexual feelings into a children's book or if that would seem like much too far out.
Well, I have to correct something you say, or at least I don't agree with something you just said, which is that he, little boy, in the night kitchen, does not have sexual feelings. Of course he does. We have them immediately on arrival. We may have them in utero. I suspect we probably do, but we just haven't traced that yet. There's nothing, in a word, that you can do that is not sexual, so far as I'm concerned. And the creative act is composed of its sexual component. As animals, which is all that we are, obviously, there's nothing we can do that isn't sexual, thank God. And I don't mean by saying sexual that is vivid, livid sex. I mean the component of sexuality, sensuality, Eroticism is part of everything, and it's what blesses our life. And instead of seeing it in an accusatory way, and I don't mean you, I mean culture in general, or blameworthy way, rather see it for the beautiful thing that it is. We can't do without it.
I remember I interviewed you, 8 years ago or something. Something that you said really stuck with me. You were talking about the monsters and where the wild things are, and you were saying that when you were young, the monsters were just adults. There were people with, like, moles on their faces and hairs growing out of their noses.
Yeah.
And all
relatives, actually.
Yeah, old relatives, exactly, relatives. And that really struck a chord. And then I started thinking, well, I'm one of those people now. I mean, I don't know if I actually have hair growing out of my nose, but you know, I have some of those things that I'm sure kind of like scare kids.
Oh, sure.
And do you have your sense of yourself as that too?
Of like, course.
You know, a monster to some kids?
Of course I am. I see it in their eyes. When I'm autographing books, which I don't like to do much anymore, and children are shoved at me.
Yeah.
They have no idea why they're on the line. They'd much rather be in the bathroom. And they're standing on line, and they're being told something which is so frightening and confusing, which is being told by mom or dad. This is the man you like so much, honey. This is the man who did your favorite book. And they clutch their book even closer, because that really means he's going to take it away. Because if this is the man's favorite book, then he's going to take your book. And the look of alarm and the tears, and they stare at me like pure hatred. Who is this elderly, short man sitting behind the desk who's going to take their book away? Then on top of that, the parent says, now give him your book, honey. He wants to write something in it. Well, there they've been told, don't write in a book. Okay? Why then is it all right for a perfect stranger to write in their book? It's horrible for them. And I become horrible. Unwittingly, I make children cry.
They cry when
they cry when they meet me, because they don't know what I'm doing. And only when they're, it's quicker with girls, because girls are smarter than boys. We all know that. They grow up faster. And girls, by the time they're 7 or 8, already know the business of autographing and what it means. Boys don't till they're about 40, I think. And so they'll pull it away. There's only one child who ever had the courage. And his father was urging him forward. I can see the hesitation. I just felt so bad for the kid. And I put my hand on the book to help draw it away from him. And he literally screamed and said, don't crap up my book. It was the bravest cry I've ever heard. I nearly wept.
So what'd you do?
Well, I took the father aside, because I think the father was going to kill the kid, because he'd embarrassed him and made everybody laugh. And I had to sit down and say how great I thought his kid was, and not to be angry with him, because the child just didn't understand what this whole nonsense, this social nonsense of autographing was all about. And it would be criminal to punish him for this.
This is great. Every time you do a book signing, it's kind of like dysfunctional family America.
That's right. Becomes into psychiatric sessions.
You must feel awful, though. You know, because you're being misunderstood by the kids who love your books.
Well, frankly, that's why I do not visit children in classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I've stopped autographing for the most part.
Uh-huh.
For that very, very reason. It's such a paradox that I, who adore them and I'm interested in their welfare, should become their enemy. It's only because it's set up that way. If I'm to visit a school, they're all warned, threatened, and browbeaten for 3 days before I get there. Now I want all of you to be nice, and you must raise your hand, and I want everyone to go to the bathroom before Mr. Sendak comes. I mean, their lives are ruined. So why should I be the person who does that to them?
Oh.
Maurice Sendak's new book is We Are All in the Dumps with Jack and Guy. He is also the founder and artistic director of the Night Kitchen Theater Company. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. In the 60s, he launched the PLO's armed struggle. In 1988, he renounced terrorism. And recently, he signed a peace agreement with Israel. Who is this man, Yasser Arafat? Coming up, British journalist Andrew Gowers, co-author of Behind the Myth, Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Revolution. And commentator Maureen Corrigan reviews The Buccaneers, the final book by Edith Wharton. After she died, the incomplete manuscript was published. Now a completed version has been released. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Coast Guard has suspended the search for those people still missing after an Amtrak train derailed early this morning in Alabama, but will continue its efforts early tomorrow. Officials say at least 40 people were killed and 13 others are still missing. The accident sent several rail cars into swamp waters north of Mobile, and as Debbie Elliott reports, before efforts had been stopped for the night, rescue teams were searching by hand.
Survivor Edmund Mouton was taking the Sunset Limited from its start in Los Angeles to its final destination in Miami.
I was asleep, and all of a sudden, next thing I knew, it was like I heard the screeching, and I looked out the window, and I just saw all this, you know, fire and stuff. And it was kind of hard to see out the window because there was also, like, smoke that was, like, orange and smoky. And the car was, like, shaking. It was like being on some sort of, like, ride or something.
Rescue teams have been working all day by boat, rail, and air to get to survivors. The cause of the accident is under investigation. The train's black box has yet to be recovered from the submerged wreckage. For National Public Radio, I'm Debbie Elliott in Mobile, Alabama.
President Clinton has been working today on his health care speech that he gives tonight to a joint session of Congress. In his speech about 1.5 hours from now, Mr. Clinton will share his vision for a revamped health care system. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
According to White House spokesman Dede Meyers, the president's speech tonight will focus on the broad principles of his plan, including providing permanent health coverage to all Americans, controlling costs, preserving quality and choice, and requiring individuals to take some responsibility for their health care. But the details, including how the plan will be paid for, will not be the main subject. It's expected the plan will be financed by a combination of sin taxes on cigarettes and alcohol, a tax on large corporations who insure their own employees, strict cost controls on Medicare and Medicaid, and a requirement that employers pay 80% of their workers' insurance costs. The president met with the bipartisan leadership of Congress this morning. Republicans and Democrats left that meeting praising the spirit of bipartisanship that has, at least for now, characterized the health care debate. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
In the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, a second passenger plane has been shot down by rebel forces. Yesterday, another plane went down over the Black Sea. According to Russian news reports, 80 people were killed in the latest downing as the plane was hit by a gunboat as the aircraft was getting ready to land. The plane yesterday was also hit by a heat-seeking missile fired from a gunboat. 28 people died in that attack. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 10 points to close at 3,547.02 on volume of more than 287 million shares. Trading today was heavy. This is NPR News. For the second day in a row, President Clinton has stated his support for Russian President Boris Yeltsin. Mr. Clinton called on Congress today to approve $2.5 billion in new aid to Russia, saying that the United States has to be on the side of democracy. Secretary of State Warren Christopher said today that there is little question that Yeltsin is the president of his country. One day after he dissolved the Russian parliament and set new elections for December. A new hard-line government in Russia is being ignored by other Western governments. Syrian President Assad, after talks today with Egyptian President Mubarak, repeated his complaint that he was not consulted on the PLO's secret talks with Israel. Laurie Neff reports from Cairo.
Syrian President Assad says his people were very hurt when they heard about the Israeli-Palestinian agreement signed in Washington September 13th. Assad, however, says his country remains committed to peace and that the Israeli-PLO peace accord won't affect Syria's disposition toward the peace process. In an interview published in an Egyptian magazine today, President Mubarak says he thinks Israel may be ready to stage a four-month withdrawal from the Golan Heights in return for peace with Syria. Today's summit was held in the port city of Alexandria, the site of Mubarak's meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin on Sunday. Following his talks with Rabin, Mubarak predicted an Israeli-Syrian declaration of principles could be signed within months. For National Public Radio, I'm Laurie Neff in Cairo.
Officials of the International Monetary Fund have changed their forecast of world economic growth to 1.2%. Earlier this year, the IMF had predicted stronger growth through next year of 3.2%. The IMF forecast U.S. economic growth this year at 2.7% and 2.6% next year. In trading today in Europe, the U.S. dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, sitting in for Terry Gross, who's under the weather today. But earlier this week, Terry recorded this interview about Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat.
Until last week, it was easy for many people to think of Yasser Arafat in two-dimensional terms, terrorist. But now that Americans have seen him smiling while shaking the hand of Yitzhak Rabin on the White House lawn, more people are wondering who he really is and why he's now decided to change course. My guest Andrew Gowers is the co-author of a biography of Arafat called Behind the Myth. Gowers is former Middle East editor of the Financial Times in London and is now foreign editor. Gowers is joining us on the phone from his office in London. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi.
Is there a lot of mystery surrounding Arafat's background, and does he encourage that?
Yes, there is, and yes, he does. He is a man who has created deliberately over the years a number of myths around himself, hasn't given much of his private life away, and really it's the habits of an underground guerrilla leader grown up in the 60s. It even extends to his birthplace. You know, he's told different people at different times that he was born in different places. And we had to rummage around in the records of the university in Cairo to discover that he actually was born in Cairo, although he has claimed to have been born in Jerusalem and indeed in Gaza.
Where did he grow up?
He grew up in his early years in Cairo, went to university there, studied engineering with a special reference to sewerage, and ended up graduating from there and also spending his time, of course, while he was at university as a student organizer, which is where his involvement in the Palestinian cause really begins.
Where was Arafat during the 1948 war when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians fled what was Palestine?
Well, he was in and around Egypt. He claims to have been the youngest or one of the youngest Palestinians fighting with the Palestinian forces in Palestine as Israel fought its war of independence. The evidence that we assembled suggested that he may have been doing a bit of gun running from Egypt and from the desert of Egypt, where he was finding weapons buried from the Second World War, but that he wasn't actually involved in frontline fighting.
If his parents had been living in Cairo and he had been living in Cairo in 1948, yes, they were all in Cairo in 1948?
That's right.
What family ties did he have to Palestine at the time?
Well, he had relatives in various parts. He had relatives in Gaza, and in fact still has relatives in Gaza. And he had other relatives in a house near the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall of Jerusalem, in a house there, which is, I'm not sure whether it still exists. But he used to visit the ones in Jerusalem as a child for periods of several weeks at a time. And really, I think, got into the subject of what was unfolding in Palestine through those visits.
Now, in 1952, Arafat was elected president of the Palestinian Students League. What kind of leader was he when he was a student?
Well, he was a sort of hyperactive, whirling about kind of leader, which is what he's always been. He was very fond of the publicity stunt. In fact, the first sort of public appearance that he makes, at least on the record, is in the pages of Al Ahram newspaper, the Cairo newspaper, where he is pictured presenting a petition signed, he says, in blood to President Nasser of Egypt, saying, "Do not forget Palestine." He was very late, pathologically late to lots of meetings. He liked to organize demonstrations to improve Palestinian students' welfare in Egypt. And even on one occasion, there was a demonstration at the Arab League headquarters there, which he arrived late for. Some of his colleagues were arrested, but he was so late that he avoided that fate.
British journalist Andrew Gower speaking with Terry Gross. More in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to Terry's interview with Andrew Gowers, co-author of Behind the Myth, Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Revolution.
How much of his long tenure as the head of the PLO do you think is a tribute to his charisma and his skilled leadership? And how much of it do you think is a result of authoritarianism?
I think charisma is putting it a bit strongly. He's not a totally charismatic man. He's not a great orator, for example. He doesn't speak very well. But he is somebody who is just obsessively and hyperactively engaged in it all the time. And I think that it's that constant maneuvering, whether it's as a student leader in the 50s or as a guerrilla leader in the 60s or ultimately as a man sort of strutting the diplomatic stage with Arab and other statesmen. He's just been constantly at it. And you know, he's also a workaholic. I mean, he wins, and therefore he's won people's respect by the fact that he's that engaged in the cause. And he's also outmaneuvered them all because he's been up earlier and goes to bed later than most of them.
You've interviewed Arafat several times, yes?
Yes.
Have you been able to get him to discuss sponsoring acts of terrorism? You know, the violence that the PLO committed?
When he, and it's some while since I saw him, but when he has been approached on that subject by any number of interviewers, he has had a habit of flying off into a rage. It's rather striking that whereas some of his colleagues have developed a rather sort of measured way of talking about that period, saying, well, that was that the Palestinian movement was desperate at that time, and that's all we could, that was our only avenue for action. Arafat has just sought to distance himself from it and to deny that he was involved, and basically to say, "Are you calling me a terrorist?" And cutting the conversation off. On occasion, he's actually walked off camera on interviews when he's been approached on that subject.
What have your interviews with him been like?
I find him evasive. I mean, he's somebody who you can get only so far with in eliciting information about his life and about his career. And on occasion, if you cross-check the information that he gives you, which is, as I say, limited in amount, you find that it's embroidered or laced with various elements of fiction. And I sort of began to wonder in talking to him whether he'd not been spinning some of these lines for so long that he actually started to believe them himself. The birthplace was one, the fact that he claimed to be a millionaire was another, and various inflations of the importance of Palestinian actions under his command that he's spilled out over a long time. That's of course part of his effort to create an aura of leadership around himself.
What have you been most impressed with about him?
I think his sheer survivability, the fact that, you know, he's been through any number of physical scrapes of a quite mortally dangerous kind, including assassination attempts by Israel when they bombed his headquarters in Tunis in the mid-1980s, assassination attempts by Arab leaders or their armies or security forces, of which there have been actually more, and then political oblivion beckoning at various times. I mean, the number of times that he has got into a really bad political hole, sometimes those of his own making, but also of his enemies' making, and the world's press has written him off and said, well, he can't possibly bounce back from that one. And at those points, it almost becomes a sort of racing certainty that he will come up with some great new gambit, either of a short-term or even of a dramatic and strategic kind, that will put him back in the game.
What were you able to find out about the amount of respect Arafat has within the different Palestinian movements?
Oh, a great deal. I mean, he is somebody who they all regard with a really kind of rich mixture of emotions. On the one hand, they think, well, he's a tactically brilliant man who has sort of maneuvered us through all this. On another level, they think that he's an autocratic leader who doesn't share any real insights into what he's doing or consult anybody. He keeps, for example, the purse strings very tightly under his control. And there's a long-standing demand, which actually first surfaced in the mid-60s, for that he become a more democratic, consultative leader. And some of the older generation of Palestinians regard him as a bit of a clown, a mixture of a sort of conjurer on the one hand and a slightly sad antic figure on the other. But overarching all that, I think there is a genuine appreciation in certainly many of the older Palestinians and a fair number of the younger ones too, that this man has become a sort of national figurehead, a national symbol. They may not like his individual actions or his individual policies, but he's sort of become indispensable in that sense alone.
Was there a feeling that if he hadn't been at the center of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, that the Palestinian issue might not have remained as alive, that the Palestinian people might not have remained as united?
I think very much so. I mean, the fact that his overriding consideration has never been particularly ideological. He's always, you know, said I can be left-wing when I talk to left-wingers and right-wing when I talk to right-wingers and Islamic when I talk to Muslims. That has stood him in good stead within the movement, which is a very diverse, scattered, fractured movement. After all, Palestinians are living in many countries of the Arab world, some as refugees, some as businessmen, and so forth. That also has enabled him to appeal to different sponsors at different times. He won Chinese support as a great liberation leader. He won Soviet support for a while too, for quite a long time too. And he won the support of conservative and deeply cautious countries like Saudi Arabia by his Islamic tinge. So there is this sort of really multicolored aspect to him that has been important in preserving Palestinian unity and keeping the show going.
Arafat is in his mid-60s now, yes?
He's 64.
Do you think that his age has anything to do with his change in strategy?
I think it must do. I mean, he has confided to friends on a number of occasions, people that we interviewed, that he did not want to go down in history as the latest in a long line of Palestinian leaders who just said no to everything in the hope of getting something better and ending up by getting nothing. And he's very much haunted by the memory of his predecessor, Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem and the leader of the abortive All-Palestine government, who basically faded away and is now enjoys a certain notoriety. Arafat wanted to do something, to achieve something, whatever it was. And as age advanced, I think he must have been more and more conscious of that. There have been other changes that have come over him in the last couple of years. He got married, for example, to a young Palestinian lady called Suha, And you know, that was a very big surprise, because he's been a lone wolf for much of his life, and much speculation concerning his personal life. He always said he was married to the revolution and would, by implication, wouldn't get married to a woman. But that is what he's now done. So there's a certain slight domestication creeping into his life.
I think Arafat started heading in the direction we saw him go in last week, at least back in 1988, when he said that he was ready to recognize Israel and renounce terrorism. What kind of change happened to him back in 88?
Well, I think it goes back a bit further than that. It really, in a sense, goes back crucially to 1982 and the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. I mean, at that time, and over the previous 8 or 9 years, Arafat has established a state within a state that he ruled, a fiefdom in Lebanon. And the Israelis, under Menachem Begin and Ariel Sharon in 1982, invaded Lebanon in great number to root out that state within a state and expel the Palestinian army, as it was then becoming. It was becoming more of a conventional army than a guerrilla force. From Lebanon, and his movement was scattered to the four winds. Off he went with his political leadership to faraway Tunis, hundreds of miles away across the Mediterranean, where they sat in their villas and they wondered what military option they had left. They didn't really ever have much of a military option, although they tried. But the political route at that point began to loom larger. So I think that, you know, 88 was certainly a milestone along the way when the Palestine National Council, their parliament, recognized Israel, accepted a two-state solution of a Palestinian state alongside Israel, and renounced terrorism. He subsequently pronounced the words as clearly as he thought he could to the United Nations in Geneva in December of 1988. And that, of course, opened the way to a dialogue with the U.S. Now, there have been bumps and detours along the way, but what has happened this in the last few weeks was really set in train then, I think, and it took a government in Israel that was prepared to see what was going on and seize the moment for that actually to become reality.
Andrew Gower spoke earlier this week with Terry Gross. He's the co-author of the book Behind the Myth, Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Revolution. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about some of the stories they'll be covering today. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Marty. We'll be hearing about the train crash near Mobile, Alabama today, the deadliest in the history of Amtrak. Also, reaction to Boris Yeltsin's suspension of parliament, reaction in Russia. And we'll be talking with a woman in the city of Chelyabinsk, where not only is the national government of Russia divided, but the local government is divided also between pro and anti-Yeltsin factions and pro and anti-reformers. Also, on the eve of President Clinton's address on health care reform, Linda Wertheimer visits a hospital and talks with patients, doctors, administrators, everyone to hear what they hope for in reform.
Robert, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Edith Wharton has long been recognized as one of America's great novelists, but these days she's also a hot property. Her novella, Ethan Frome, was made into a movie earlier this year. The film version of her novel, The Age of Innocence, was just released last week. And this week, her final novel, The Buccaneers, was published. Critic Maureen Cargan says it's a romantic potboiler, but she recommends that before you read The Buccaneers, you first bone up on your basic Wharton masterpieces.
When Edith Wharton died in 1937, she left behind a manuscript of The Buccaneers that was about three-fifths done, plus some notes on where the plot was heading. The following year, the incomplete manuscript was published, and the reviews in both Time magazine and the Christian Science Monitor gushed about how The Buccaneers might have been Wharton's masterpiece. That's been the underground buzz on The Buccaneers ever since, which is why some of us Wharton fans felt queasy when we heard that a scholar and novelist named Marion Mainwaring was completing the novel. We needn't have worried about Mainwaring meddling with great art. I don't know what kind of cocktails those 30s reviewers were tossing down when they wrote their raves, but The Buccaneers certainly isn't Wharton's Sistine Chapel. It's more like her Mount Rushmore, entertaining, formulaic, and uncharacteristically unsubtle. Towards the end of her life, Wharton wrote a lot for women's magazines, and the Buccaneers testifies to their sentimentalizing influence. But because the Buccaneers is really just a rollicking romance novel, it doesn't matter so much that Mainwaring wrote the last part. Trust me, Danielle Steele could have completed the Buccaneers, and you wouldn't know the difference. The novel opens in the summer of 1873 in Saratoga, where a bevy of American beauties are scheming to find husbands. The five girls, who are the daughters of newly made millionaires, can't elbow their way into the private balls where old money meets and mates. Enter Laura Testvalley, who's hired as a governess to the youngest girl, the sensitive Nan St. George. Miss Testvalley suggests everybody might have better luck in England, where the impoverished aristocracy would welcome a lovely infusion of cash. The female buccaneers dutifully cross the Atlantic, and Nan hits the jackpot. She marries Ushant Foliot, the Duke of Tintagel. In best Gothic fashion, however, the Duke turns out to be gloomy and cold, and Nan falls in love with another man. Many chapters of bosom heaving follow. In the early part of this novel, an occasional sentence jumps out that sounds like vintage, understated Wharton. For instance, when describing Miss Testvalley's job, Wharton writes that she finished young ladies whom nature seems scarcely to have begun. But the unpleasant surprise here is how blunt most of Wharton's language is. Criticizing the invasion of American girls, an old geezer named Sir Helmsley Thwart calls them a spitting, tobacco-chewing crew who'll pollute his house. In masterpieces like The Age of Innocence and The House of Mirth, Wharton would have had Sir Helmsley indicate his displeasure simply by a fleeting arch of his furry eyebrow. Apparently, Wharton's original language was even blunter. In her author's note, Mainwaring says she revised passages where Wharton referred to racial matters in terms that would be offensive to modern readers. Too bad. One of the reasons why even a mediocre Wharton novel, like this one, is still interesting is because Wharton was such a discerning chronicler of society's rituals and prejudices. This cleaned-up, completed Buccaneers is an amiable diversion for a rainy autumn afternoon. But better yet, read the great novels where Edith Wharton is writing at the height of her powers in her own delicately calibrated and utterly devastating voice.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Edith Wharton's final novel, The Buccaneers. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Vablaitis, Chris Fraley, and Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscow-Wain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, unraveling President Clinton's health care reform package. We talk with economist Uwe Reinhardt and medical ethicist Arthur Kaplan about the medical, social, and economic aspects of the plan. Join us for the next Fresh Air.